Shrink Wrap Radio number 370, Mindfulness and Loving Relationships with Dr. John Amodeo.
It's Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head. And now here's your host, Dr. Dave.
My guest today is Dr. John Amodeo, and we'll be discussing his most recent book, Exploring Mindfulness and Loving Relationships. Dr. John Amodeo has been a licensed marriage and family therapist for over 30 years. He's the author of the new book, Dancing with Fire, A Mindful Way to Loving Relationships. His other books include The Authentic Heart and Love and Betrayal, which have just been translated into Mandarin. He co-authored a chapter with Sue Johnson on EFT, that is Emotional Focus Therapy, and Buddhism, in the Emotionally Focused Casebook, and he is a certified focusing trainer. He is a former writer and contributing editor for Yoga Journal, an adjunct faculty member of Meridian University, and has conducted workshops internationally on relationships and couples therapy. He has appeared as a featured guest on programs that included CNN, CNBC, Donahue, and New Dimensions Radio. Now, here's the interview. Dr. John Amodeo, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you so much. Great to be here.
Well, it's great to have you here. And I believe we have a friend in common, Larry Robinson.
Yes.
He had contacted me, actually, I think a couple, 2 or 3 years ago, suggesting that I interview you about one of your earlier books. And unfortunately, I was swamped at the time. And but Larry and I have been in a men's group together for over 20 years, and he was actually one of the early guests on this show.
Oh, wonderful.
Yeah. Well, for starters, I have to ask you if your last name, if Amodeo, is the name you were born with or one you adopted, because to me it translates as I love God.
That's right. You know your Latin. Yes, so, Amodeo means I love God. And now, yes, that's my original name. It's a Sicilian name. I'm Italian.
Wow. So I wonder to what extent that name determined your destiny. Because you've written 3 books. This is your 3rd book on love and relationships.
Yeah, my 4th, actually.
Your 4th? Sorry. So how is it that this has emerged as a theme in your life?
Well, probably because I needed to learn a lot about relationships.
Yeah, we generally teach the stuff that we need to learn, right?
Right, and you know, to me, it's the most fulfilling part of our life, my life. Mm-hmm. And certainly didn't get much instruction or guidance or help growing up about how to have a rich, deep, connected relationship. So I had to figure it out on my own.
I love the introduction to your book where you describe how for many years you felt you were straddling 2 worlds without being fully comfortable in either one. One was the spiritual world and the other was the world of psychotherapy. Now, of course, your whole book is sort of about that, but maybe you can give us some of the, you know, tell us about it.
Yeah, well, I was very fortunate when I was in college around age 20. I got involved in what was called a sensitivity group. And for the first time, I got introduced to feelings. I didn't know anything about feelings up until then. I mean, I'm sure I was having them, but I didn't know how to identify them. Mm-hmm. And that was a really helpful group to get connected to what we're feeling. And at the same time, I was interested in Taoism and Buddhism and Hinduism. I took a class at Hofstra University on comparative Eastern literature. It really awakened me to the depths of the spiritual world. So I found my spiritual friends were very kind of had aversion to intimate relationships. They would see those kind of people as relationship junkies and too attached. And the people in the psychological world thought the spiritual people were just doing this navel-gazing stuff and they were just self-absorbed, narcissistic people. So I didn't feel comfortable in either world, but I know they each had something really important about life to teach me. So I was on both tracks, and gradually over the years, I've been finding some way to integrate them.
Yeah, and that's really what your book is about, and I'm sure that you're not alone in that struggle that other people have have pondered the challenges of living in both worlds.
Yes, indeed, yes.
Early on in the introduction, you share a Chinese story about an old woman who supported a monk for 20 years. Do you remember that story?
I do. Yes, it's a Zen story. And yes, this woman supported this monk for 20 years. He lived in a hut, and she fed him, gave him money, whatever, brought him food. And then one day, she wanted to kind of test his spiritual development. So she sent a very young, beautiful woman, rich in desire, and instructed her to go to the monk, start to stroke him, and then ask him, "How do you feel?" That's every monk's worst nightmare, right?
I wouldn't know.
So the woman did. She went to see him. She started stroking him and said, "How do you feel?" And he said, "I feel like a withering stone on a rock, a withering tree on a rock in winter, totally without warmth." So to him, that was the epitome of spiritual progress. He was totally in his still, absorbed, transcended meditative state. So the woman, young woman went back to this older woman who was supporting the monk, told him the story. And she said, "That guy is a total fake." And she quickly evicted him, and she burned down his hut. It's being a spiritual fake.
Oh.
Yeah. You know, the Zen stories, they always have dramatic endings, right?
Yeah. So what are we to make of that story?
Yeah, well, I think what the older woman was wisely recognizing is that this monk had simply replaced one desire with another. He was now so attached to his meditative absorption that he wasn't available for human relationships, for human connection, for love, for developing that other part of his life. That's relational.
Yeah.
I
love that you sprinkle so many stories throughout your narrative, not just Zen stories, but also from your own life and experience. And I hope you'll feel free to do so throughout our conversation. Anything that comes to mind, be sure to share it with us.
Right. Yeah, stories are wonderful teachings, aren't they?
Yes, they are.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Now, I believe you commented that you have observed that there's something in traditional Eastern teachings about attachment and desire that can get in the way of relationships.
Right. Yeah, I think a lot of people interpret the Buddha's second noble truth, the cause of suffering. You know, the first noble truth, of course, is life is saturated with suffering and anguish. And then the second noble truth, the cause of suffering, people often think that it's desire, when actually desire is just part of being alive. It's more clinging and craving that creates the suffering.
Yeah, I think you said there's a mistranslation.
Yeah, it's tanha, T-A-N-H-A, is often translated as desire, but the better translation is thirst or craving. Mm-hmm. So it opens the door to the possibility that we can allow desire, allow ourselves to have our basic human longings, and not get caught up in clinging and craving. Mm-hmm. So to engage with the desire, to engage with the longing, that's a crucial part of the practice, to engage with our desires. What are they trying to tell us? Which ones are maybe going to lead us toward more suffering? Which desires might lead us toward more connection, more joy, more expansion, more openness? And then to listen to our bodily felt sense about that. Listen to our inner intelligence guiding us forward in terms of what desires are going to lead toward growth and connection and good things, and which are likely to lead toward suffering.
I think the title of your book might be particularly relevant here. The title is Dancing with Fire. What is it that you mean to communicate in that title?
Right, yeah, that's a great question. What we need to learn how to do is to engage with the fiery desires and the feelings connected to our desires, engage with them, be with them, hold them in a gentle way. It's like dancing with fire without getting burned. So to be with those strong feelings, to work with them, to engage with them, to hear what they're trying to tell us about our life. Feelings often have a message, a meaning, some wisdom. If we can just decipher it, hear what life's trying to tell us through our feelings, and then follow that as a way to move forward in our life. So yeah, dancing with fire, dancing with the intensity.
Yeah. So sometimes our notions, our ideas can get in the way. You seem to suggest that there's a problem with our notions about spirituality and Buddhism in the West that has created a problem, a divide, and that the problem's not so much in the teachings as in what we've done with them. Do I have that right?
Yeah, I think we often misinterpret Buddhism. We misinterpret the teaching. Oops, hold on a second. Yeah, we misinterpret the teachings that we're trying to eliminate desire. We're trying to eliminate attachments. One of the chapters in the book is about is suffering created by attachment or non-attachment. And often what we do is we're trying to get rid of the attachments instead of realizing that healthy bonding, healthy attachment is simply part of being alive.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a good thing.
You quote both Carl Jung and the Dalai Lama as suggesting that it's a mistake for us Westerners to try to swallow Eastern spirituality whole.
Right, exactly, yeah. Carl Jung, the Dalai Lama, Thich Nhat Hanh, they all talk about how we need to integrate Buddhism into our Western psyche, into our Western world. So, you know, we're Western people. We grow up with romantic interest, love. Pursuing love relationships is an important part of our psyche. It's deeply ingrained into us.
Yeah, I would say it's deeply ingrained. Just about every song that you hear on the radio is about love.
Exactly. So our Western path is integrating the path of love and intimacy into our spiritual practice. You know, it's not. I think people who view spirituality as a path of transcendence, to get beyond things, get beyond our attachments are missing the boat.
Yeah, related to that, I love the title of your first chapter, Off the Cushion and Into Life. That's somewhat self-explanatory, but tell us about what you're getting at there, nevertheless.
Yeah, you know, often when there's a conflict in relationships, you know, because I've been working as a psychotherapist now for over 30 years, and people often come who have a spiritual practice, and they're very uncomfortable. They have an aversion toward feelings that come up in their relationship. So whenever an uncomfortable feeling comes up or a conflict comes up in the relationship, they might flee to their other lover, the meditation cushion.
Mm-hmm.
It just drives their partner crazy because what they're really doing is they're stonewalling. They're avoiding the engagement. They're not dancing with fire. They're shutting down. They're not engaging with the other person in an intimate way. And it just creates a bad cycle in their relationship where their partner feels like they're not interested, they don't care. So yeah, to get off the cushion and get into life, engage with your feelings, engage with your desires, engage with other people.
I love your courageous confession. I think it's in the first chapter that you're not a great, quotes, not a great meditator. It certainly reassured me. Tell us, if you will, about what it means to not be a great meditator.
Well, I tell this story. Maybe it's a humorous story in the beginning. I was on a meditation retreat, 2-week retreat, and toward the end of the retreat, I was having this desire for a pizza, and my friend and I decided that we're going to leave the sanctuary of the retreat setting. We went out to have a pizza together, and we engaged in intimate, you know, not intimate, but just in nice, deep conversation. And there was something missing for me on that retreat, which is engaging with other human beings. And I know the retreat setting is supposed to be a retreat from everything, and you just go inside, and you just be with your experience. But I really need to integrate that with human relating. It just makes everything go a lot better. There's a longing in us for the connection, and I think what we need to do is integrate our meditation practice with intimate connections and friendships.
And pizza,
yeah. I mean, I do meditate, and I don't want to, don't get me wrong, I think it's really valuable. You know, usually every night I spend a little time meditating, and it makes, actually, having a meditation practice makes connections richer. Because the meditation is so helpful in getting some stillness inside, some inner quiet. It's great for self-soothing. And then from that deeper, still, quiet place, the connections with others can become so much richer and deeper.
Mm-hmm. Now, you say spirituality is a hazardous word. What's your definition or understanding of spiritual? of spirituality.
Yeah, the word spirit comes from the word breath. So to me, spirituality means being alive, being connected to what is, the aliveness of being connected to life. So it's not a spirituality where you're just developing this serene disconnect, this kind of sereneness, this inner quiet that's disconnected from relating. To me, spirituality is about connection, connecting with something beyond our ego, connecting with something larger than ourselves.
I must say I feel a lot of kinship with what you're writing about here. Around 40 years ago, I published a brief article on anger, raising the question of how to deal with it and the whole issue of detachment versus denial. And it was stimulated by my observation at that time that some spiritual seekers, in the name of detachment, were actually denying their anger. Mm. And I concluded that the way you can tell whether or not you're engaging in detachment or denial was by listening to your body. So I think I was wrestling with a question closely related to the issues that you're raising here in your book.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. And I do talk about focusing in the book that Eugene Genlin developed and did a lot of research on what helps people grow when they're in psychotherapy. And he found people were connecting to their bodies. People were really dropping down into their bodily felt experience of what is, instead of living in their heads and in their ideas about things.
Yeah, I picked up on that earlier. You said something about the felt sense, and that little tick mark went off in my head. Ah, Eugene Genlin, focusing.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're familiar with that.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, it's very helpful. Very helpful integration with spiritual practice to open to our life of feelings.
Yeah. Well, I think we share a number of things in common, at least a couple of things in common. One is a longstanding interest in Eastern spirituality. And another is one you referred to earlier, past experiences with sensitivity training groups or mm-hmm. encounter groups, which I was very involved with while I was in graduate school. In what way did these two sets of experiences or interests support one another and clash with one another for you?
Yeah, well, you know, the story comes to mind where I went to the leader of the sensitivity group, which I was really loving. And I said, you know, what about meditation and spiritual practice? You know, isn't that an important part of life too? And he said something like, well, I don't know about that. I think that's just avoiding feelings when people get involved in that kind of path. And that was not wholly satisfying. Mm-hmm. And then when I would ask the meditation teachers, well, what about feelings? Isn't it important to honor our feelings? And often they would say, well, that's just going to feed the feelings. That's going to make you get attached to the feelings. And that's not really part of the spiritual practice. So that's changed a lot over the years, fortunately. We're talking about the mid-1970s when I first got introduced. So the spiritual teachers have become more sophisticated now, the meditation teachers. Like I really like Jack Kornfield, for example. Mm-hmm. I love his teaching. He's aware of feelings and the importance of them. But yeah, when I grew up with this, it was hard to find common ground, how they intersected with each other. But it's a lot clearer to me now. That's why I wrote this book, how to integrate them.
Yeah. Yeah. I like the distinction you make between vertical spirituality and horizontal spirituality. Tell us about that.
Yeah, it's vertical spirituality is like the path of transcendence. Maybe people are trying to get absorbed in what's called the jhanic states, just really beyond, almost trying to get beyond experiencing. And it's you know, it's probably very blissful and very enjoyable in many ways, and I think there's value in it to some extent. But I think there's a danger of getting so absorbed in that transcended vertical state that you lose your sense of a horizontal spirituality, which is connecting to other people, connecting to nature, connecting to life. So, yeah, to me, a horizontal spirituality is where we're in the world. You know, Martin Buber is really famous for that. He wrote the book I and Thou. For him, spiritual practice was all about connecting with people.
Why is it that achieving intimacy with another at times can seem as elusive as achieving enlightenment?
Yeah, that's a good point. There's a lot of growth for intimacy to really be beautifully deep and stable and rich and alive for us, where there's a lot of inner growth that's required for that, really knowing what we're experiencing, being really curious about what's really happening deep down. You know, we often get hijacked by our amygdala, the part of our brain that goes into the fight, flight, freeze mode. So in relationships, we're very quick to blame and accuse and attack and judge other people. You know, why aren't we analyze other people? You're self-centered, you're selfish, everything's about you. Instead of just slowing down, getting connected to what we're really feeling inside. You know, I feel sad when we don't spend time together. I'm feeling a disconnection lately. I'm really missing you. I really enjoy our time together. And, you know, to vulnerably express from your heart what you're feeling, what you're wanting, it's much more likely to bring the other person toward you and create a safe climate for the intimacy that you're longing for. Rather than saying, you're never home, you're always coming home late, your work is much more important than me, why don't you just spend the night at the office? You know, those kind of blaming, attacking statements, they're not creating a safe climate for intimacy.
Yeah, longing. You talk about our longing for connection, and you raise an interesting question. Is our longing a destructive force, or is it a gift?
Right.
Yeah, so tell us about the two poles there.
Yeah, and longing just simply is, so we might as well accept it, embrace it. I mean, longing is life speaking through us. Life longs for more of itself, in a way. To honor the longing, to hear what it's trying to tell us, it's a gift. It connects us. You know, the first noble truth of the Buddha, actually, life is suffering. We might also understand that as disconnection. Mm. Disconnection is really what creates suffering. Feeling isolated, feeling so alone is what creates suffering. So longing is the longing to get beyond our isolated self. It's longing to connect. It's a longing for something that's rich and beautiful and important to listen to it, hear where it's trying to guide us.
Yeah. Yeah, you know.
It's a sacred longing. I call it a sacred longing in the book.
Uh-huh. That makes me think of the poetry of Rumi.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
Rumi's really writes really, really beautifully about that sweet longing. There's a sweetness in it. There's a fire in it. There's a sweetness in it. There's a depth in it.
Earlier, you made a distinction between desire and what you talk about as craving, grasping, clinging. So, what do you know about craving, grasping, and clinging?
Well, I think people, I'm glad you asked that, because I think what we need to do is to realize that we need to be less attached to some things so we can be more connected to other things. Clinging and craving, we often cling and crave to things in a way that doesn't allow us to connect in a deeper way. Let me give you an example. That probably sounds pretty vague. You know, often we're not aware of what exactly we're clinging to. The problem isn't that we're clinging to other people. The problem is we're clinging to things that disconnect us from other people. We're clinging to being right, wanting to be right all the time, for example. We're clinging to our interpretations of what's wrong with the other person instead of looking at our own part in the conflict. You know, we cling and we get attached to our ideology, our belief system.
Yes.
Instead of opening to our feelings, our sadness, our hurts, our fears, and sharing that with each other. You know, our ideologies really often disconnect us from each other. Cling to our religious beliefs, our political ideology, make other people wrong. So that creates a lot of suffering, a lot of disconnection. We're not available then to listen, to really hear what's happening with the other person when our mind is so filled with our own ideas and our own interpretations of what's happening. There's an old saying that God gave us two ears and one mouth for a reason. You know, because listening is much harder than speaking. So we need two ears. And we should spend more time listening than speaking, being receptive to what's happening in the world of the other person. Helps create that safe, intimate climate.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You suggest we can make friends with clinging and craving. That sounds paradoxical a little bit. How are we to do that?
Yeah, because in Eastern teachings, the way people often interpret it is we have to get rid of clinging. You know, since clinging and craving are the cause of suffering, okay, I'm on it. I'm going to get rid of clinging and craving. But then that just becomes another thing we're clinging to. Now we're desiring getting rid of clinging and craving. Like, like that Zen monk that we talked about earlier, was into meditative absorption. So, yeah, the idea is not to get rid of anything, but just to notice exactly what is. So if we feel a desire, we connect with our body, we notice we're clinging to something, clinging to being right, whatever it is, just notice it and work with it. Well, maybe I'm not right. You know, maybe I'm just feeling hurt in this relationship and I need to express that. Feeling some loneliness, feeling some sadness, feeling some fear. And just softening, having a kind of a courageous vulnerability where we're honoring what we're feeling and just being really honest with ourselves about what we're experiencing and sharing our felt experience. That's really the key. Sharing our felt experience is the path, and that is the path to working with clinging and craving and allowing the clinging and craving to soften. Mm-hmm. You know, part of it too is there's a story about the Dalai Lama that comes to mind. You know, often people on spiritual paths, have you noticed this, Dave? People on spiritual paths, often they think they're supposed to get beyond their uncomfortable, unpleasant feelings.
Oh, yes.
And there's a story that the Dalai Lama, where a psychiatrist was interviewing him, and he asked him, is there anything about your life that you regret? And he thought about it for a long time, and he said, yeah. He told the story of an older man who came to him. He wanted to do this advanced esoteric practice. And the Dalai Lama said, you know, this practice is very rigorous. It's really more for younger people. I'd recommend this other practice. So the old man went off and he killed himself.
Oh, gee.
I know. So he could be reincarnated as a younger man who could then do this practice that he wanted to do.
Oh, my goodness.
Not recommended.
Yeah, really.
So the psychiatrist asked him, well, how did you get over that regret? And the Dalai Lama paused for a long time before he answered. And what I think he was doing, the Dalai Lama, he was kind of focusing. He didn't give a quick answer. He paused, he kind of went inside. And what do you think the Dalai Lama said in response? He said, I didn't get over it. I haven't gotten over it. You know, it's still there. He says it doesn't hold him back in his life, but that feeling is still there. And to me, that's a wonderful story because, especially for what the Dalai Lama didn't say. He didn't say, well, he created his own reality for himself. I mean, that's, I don't know about you, but that kind of drives me crazy when people use expressions like that.
Yeah.
Well, I'm not responsible for him. That was his choice.
Oh, yeah.
You know, I hate, that's another New Age rationalization. You know, this is a relational growth.
Yeah, kind of an unfortunate, blocking on the right word here, an unfortunate gift of a certain approach to Gestalt therapy.
Yes, right. I'm not here to live up to the Gestalt prayer. I'm not here to live up to your expectations.
Yeah.
It's beautiful. If not, it's okay. It can't be helped. But yeah, it's a very kind of self-centered philosophy in many ways, right?
Yeah.
Yes, so the Dalai Lama said, yeah, he didn't get over it. And that's a great teaching for all of us. It's okay to have feelings. You know, it's okay to be a little uncomfortable about things sometimes. It's just part of being human. We have different feelings, fears, regrets, sadness. And embracing that humanity is a crucial part of the spiritual path. That's like one of the core reasons I wrote the book, to convey that message. The spiritual path is about embracing our humanity, not trying to transcend it. And the Dalai Lama, that's a beautiful story for not trying to transcend our human limitations and vulnerabilities.
You know, thinking about spirituality one hand and psychology on the other, I'm freshly struck by the irony that in spirituality we're talking about not becoming attached, and in psychology the really hot topic these days is attachment theory. And you ask the question, is, you know, you actually write about that in your book, and you ask the question, is suffering caused by attachment or non-attachment? So maybe you can take us through some of the highlights in relation to those issues.
Yeah, I think that's one of the real key chapters in the book, that people often think suffering is created by attachment, but which is simply, you know, what we're learning now from neuroscience and how we're wired, is that we're wired for connection. We don't do well without loving, caring human connections. Our immune system suffers. Our immune system doesn't do as well. We're not as happy. So yeah, we're wired for connection, and a lot of suffering comes because we're not attached in a healthy way to other people. Maybe the word we need to use there is connected. People don't like, spiritual people tend to not like the word attached. But what it really is connected. Suffering is caused by non-connection. Mm-hmm. It's not caused by connection. It's caused by non-connection, or non-attachment, if you prefer that word. So we, you know, there's a way to be healthily attached, healthily connected to other people. That's beautiful. And then and that's a legitimate human desire, not to be transcended, but to be engaged with, to work with it, or I prefer to say engage with it.
You take up a very difficult topic in the book about the disappointment that many spiritual seekers have experienced in relation to their spiritual teacher, their guru, their Zen master, whatever.
Right.
And I would love to hear you rhapsodize on that a bit.
Yeah, I think that chapter is called Trust Your Guru or Trust Yourself. Mm-hmm. And often we give the responsibility to another, a teacher, and look to them for guidance in such a way that we lose connection with our own sense of inner guidance. I mean, my teachers and the Buddha also taught me to listen to your own experience, listen to the teachings, but see what resonates in your own experience and use that. And if it doesn't resonate, then you know, explore that. But it's most important to listen to yourself rather than listen to what somebody else is telling you how you should live your life. And that's why many people get disenfranchised when they're in spiritual communities, because they realize they were getting too attached to listening to the teacher. And these, you know, spiritual teachers can be wonderful. We have a lot to learn. We need teachers, but they're human too. We often lose sight of how they're human also.
Yeah, and you touch upon the fact that, you know, there have been some fairly visible incidents have come to light where spiritual teachers have gotten sexually involved with their students, and you know, with various bad results. And I actually had the opportunity or the experience of interviewing somebody who was on the other side of that, somebody who was a Zen teacher, mm-hmm. and you know, and I put to him some fairly difficult questions, and seemed like he's still in the process of working those issues through.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think especially when Eastern teachers come over here in the West, they haven't had a lot of experience with intimate relationships. Suddenly this whole world of desire opens up that they're not familiar with. And it might be a little overwhelming for some of them. They don't know how to deal with it maybe or work with it. So they might act out in some way, because they haven't had experience with feelings. That feelings often is not part of the spiritual path for Eastern people, and working with your desires. So, yeah, it could be that. It could be lots of other things spiritual teachers can do that are harmful to, unhelpful to their students.
So not just Eastern teachers, by the way. There's some pretty prominent examples of Western teachers. So what's your advice to somebody who's felt burned in that way?
Yeah. And there sure are a lot of people, huh, who have been felt really hurt being in spiritual community. Well, it's important to learn whatever lessons you can. Maybe there was a way you gave your power away, and get your own power back, and learn what you can from that experience, and move forward, and It's a healing process. Mm-hmm. And maybe, you know, maybe also take responsibility for how you looked a little bit too much to somebody else for guidance instead of listening to yourself. And it's a sober learning that the most important thing is listen to your own experience. And
yeah.
Trust what feels right for you. And you know, often we want a father figure, a mother figure, and sometimes it's helpful to have that for a while, but you know, it's good to keep evolving and moving on and realizing that inner authority is in ourself ultimately. We have to really trust ourselves and not give our power away to somebody else.
I agree with you totally. How have the sorts of things that we've been discussing here impacted your work as a psychotherapist?
Well, often people will come to me who have a spiritual practice because people know that I'm interested in all that. and I have a meditation practice myself. So, you know, often they'll come and I can see pretty quickly that they have an aversion toward feelings or desires. They think it's something to transcend. So I try to work with them to gently encourage them to embrace their feelings, if that's part of the spiritual path. And I think spiritual practice, too, has helped me just to be more empathic, more connected to myself, more compassionate for other people. I think creating a safe, compassionate place for clients is really crucial. A lot of the healing is simply in the connection with the client. So the more I'm connected to myself, the more I can make that nice connection with the other person.
Mm-hmm. So do you feel like your meditation practice helps you to do that?
Definitely. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. And not just sitting meditation, but it's just as a mindfulness practice throughout the day, just meditating throughout the day or being mindful of what is as best I can, staying in my body as best I can. It's a lifetime process. That's why they call it a practice. We don't have to be perfect at it. It's a practice.
Yes, right. Right. That's a good point.
Yeah.
I was struck in your bio that you've also used EFT, emotional freedom technique.
No. Actually, it's emotionally focused therapy for couples.
Okay. I thought I was going to go down a completely different track.
Now, I'm not familiar with the emotional freedom technique very much, although I hear good things about it. But yeah, this is Sue Johnson's work. She wrote that book, Hold Me Tight, which is great. And
yeah, I'm not familiar with that book. What did you say it is? It stands for?
Emotionally Focused Therapy for Couples.
Okay. Tell us a bit about that.
Yeah, it's very compatible with my work, as I do reference her in the book. And it's working with couples in a way where you really help each of them connect with what they're actually feeling and try to steer them away from attacks and judgments and blaming the other person and really help them find words that express what they're really feeling, what they're wanting, what they're longing for. And when two people can learn to do that with each other, it's very powerful. It's very connecting. So it's a mindfulness practice, really. Focusing is like a mindfulness practice, being mindful of our feelings. And the emotionally focused therapy is kind of like a mindfulness practice, too. It's being mindful of what you're really feeling inside, what you're really wanting. And the therapist who's trained in that has, you know, particular skills and tools to help clients move in that direction. And there's a lot more to it, of course, but that's one part of it.
Sounds like maybe I should seek out Sue Johnson as well, maybe as somebody to talk to.
Yeah, she lives in Canada. But sure, yeah, she'd probably love for you to interview her, and she has a new book out too.
Okay, well, you know, we're at the place where we should probably begin to wrap it up. I wonder if there's anything that you were hoping to talk about that we didn't get to, or any final thoughts that you'd like to leave our listeners with.
So just to summarize it, you know, another way to say it is we need to learn to work with accepting our experience instead of trying to finesse our experience. So just, you know, it's like a path of radical acceptance, if I can use a Tara Brach's term. She's a Buddhist teacher and is also a psychologist. That's a nice term for all this, too, is radical acceptance, just simply accepting ourselves just as we are, accepting our experience just as it is. And I really encourage people to learn more about focusing. I have a whole chapter on focusing as a practice of loving kindness toward ourselves. That's really a key to really be gentle with ourselves. This is something I always tell my clients. Just, you know, is there a way to be more gentle with that? Right way to be more friendly with that inside yourself? And you know, if we can kind of hold ourselves with gentleness and loving kindness and make room for the full range of our feelings, what we're longing for, brings a lot more peace to our being, and it opens life to connection. It opens us more to connecting with other people, with nature, and with life itself. So connecting with ourselves, connecting with others, connecting with life, those are three sides of the same coin, really. The way I say it sometimes is, connecting in intimate relationships and spiritual development are two sides of the same coin of awakening. We can awaken through relationship. And relationship can become a spiritual practice if we use it for that purpose.
Okay, well, that really does sum it up. And so Dr. John Amadeo, My fellow Sonoma County resident, it's nice to meet you, and I want to thank you for being my guest on Shrink Wrap Radio.
My pleasure to be here. I really appreciate your having me on.
I really appreciate Dr. John Amadeo's down-to-earth approach to spirituality and relationships. This was especially true for me in the section of his book where he deals with the difficult topic you heard me raise with him, namely that of gurus or other spiritual teachers who have abused their students sexually or in other ways. I very much agree with his guidance that spiritual seekers avoid becoming overly attached to their particular notions of spirituality or to their teachers. They need to realize that their teachers, too, are human. People who, so to speak, put on their pants one leg at a time, just like the rest of us. As human beings, they will have their own flaws. This can be difficult for us to accept. There's a part of us that's still seeking the ultimate perfect mommy or daddy. For myself, I'm skeptical of the concept of enlightened beings who are at all times and all places, permanently enlightened. I think it's much more like romantic relationships in which we go through a period of being blind to the beloved's flaws. Eventually, as a result usually of living together, the rough spots will emerge. Infatuation eventually fades, and a different sort of love, one that is not blind, can emerge. I can understand becoming infatuated with a teacher, a leader, a political figure, a friend, an idea, or an ideology. It's very human. But ultimately, I believe we need to transcend that attachment and bring our critical faculties to bear and not feel guilty when a little voice inside has doubts, questions, and so on. Seeing and accepting the feet of clay of our earthly gods is a sign of maturity, I think. I share Dr. Amadeo's emphasis upon developing a deep capacity for checking in with what he and others have called the felt sense. I believe it's one of our truest guides, and I also share his commitment to radical self-acceptance. By the way, I mentioned that John Amadeo is a fellow resident of Sonoma County and that we know people in common. So far, however, we've never met in person. Sooner or later, it's likely that our paths will cross, and I look forward to that. I'd like to give you a sense of his writing by reading a short passage at the end of the book. On page 249, he writes, "With each passing year, I notice a more tender appreciation for the precious gift of being alive. I sense a growing longing to live and love more fully and leave this earth awash in rich relationship and with minimal regrets. I recognize that embracing the nuanced feelings and longings that arise from being alive is an essential part of any spiritual path. Diverse religions have the common aim of opening our hearts to love, but in practice, religious life has often been lived, quotes, above the neck. However compelling our beliefs about love, God, or truth might be, they are limited to lofty ideas in our mind if we don't take the elevator down to the ground floor of our body and hear what it knows and needs in order to live an emotionally healthy spiritual life. A vibrant spirituality invites us to embrace all parts of our being. Wars and conflicts throughout the world are external reflections of our internal emotional war. Creating a world where peace and justice prevail requires building a critical mass of people who are cultivating equanimity within themselves and developing loving kindness toward their own vulnerabilities. This gentle attentiveness to our inner life creates the foundation for being responsive to the needs and sensitivities of our partner, friends, and community, and beyond that, our world." Close quote. So, if this kind of thinking and writing speaks to you, as always, I would encourage you to use the Amazon.com widget on our site if you decide to purchase Dr. Amadeo's book. With the holiday season coming up, it might make a good gift for someone in your life.
Hi, Dr. Dave. This is just to let you know that I really appreciate your show, Across the Ocean here in the Netherlands. I've expressed that by a small donation. With regard to the work you put into your shows, it's just a small amount, but it's another way to say I value what you do. I'll keep listening, with heart and mind.
Thank you, listener Joris in the Netherlands. Your support and encouragement of others means a great deal to me. If you've been listening to this podcast for any length of time, you probably already know that I'm a big Apple fanboy. Yes, I drank the Kool-Aid a long time ago. So today is the launch of the new iPhone S, and I'm planning later today to go to my local Apple store, probably not to buy one quite yet. I've heard already that the lines are long and the 5S is in short supply, but I'm eager to at least take a look at the demo models that they have in the store. Now, speaking of the iPhone, new listeners might not be aware that we have a Shrink Wrap Radio app for all iDevices, and for those who did not drink the Kool-Aid, we have an app for Android devices. Just look for the Apps tab on our site for full details. I have no new transcripts to announce at this time, so if you'd like to help out by transcribing one of your favorite interviews, do let me know. I spent a fair amount of time this morning troubleshooting episode number 369 on the biopsychological model of Dr. Robert Morris. It was supposed to go live yesterday morning, and I assumed it was alive and well and out there. Then I remembered to go to the feed burner tool this morning and discovered that the feed was broken, which meant it was not showing up in iTunes or for anyone who has subscribed to it. It took me some panicky time, but I did get it fixed. I really thought I might have to find and hire a WordPress consultant to bail me out. Somehow, my persistence as a problem solver usually wins the day. Knock on wood. Not to encourage superstitious thinking.
Yeah, you should really listen to that Dr. Dave show. A lot of people are tuning in. It's extremely popular. I've met Dr. Dave a couple times and listened to his show and liked it very much. There's a lot of good stuff there. And for those of you who are into what your mind is doing, it's an interesting little piece of your body. What's going on in your head? You might want to check it out. Shrink Wrap Radio. ShrinkWrapRadio.com.
Thanks, Adam Curry, the original podcaster, sometimes known as the Pod Father. Now let's take a quick dip into the old email bag. This one comes from Henry, listener Henry, who referred me to an open access article from the online journal PLOS One, which is spelled PLOS space One, which is interesting because I did some market research actually for that journal a couple of years ago. So Henry writes, "Hi, Dr. Dave, I thought you might find this article fascinating, given some of your guest speakers and your own history and interest into psychedelics. I've been a listener for years and really appreciate your podcast. Thanks for all the hard work." Well, thank you for that, for this reference, Henry, and for being a longtime listener. And Henry included the abstract from the article, and you can find that article probably somewhere on dx.plos.org. But let me read the abstract to you. The title is Psychedelics and Mental Health, a Population Study. Background. The classical serotonergic psychedelics, LSD, psilocybin, mescaline, are not known to cause brain damage and are regarded as non-addictive. Clinical studies do not suggest that psychedelics cause long-term mental health problems. Psychedelics have been used in the Americas for thousands of years. Over 30 million people currently living in the U.S. have used LSD, psilocybin, or mescaline. Continuing to read from the abstract, the objective, to evaluate the association between the lifetime use of psychedelics and current mental health in the adult population. Method, data drawn from years 2001 to 2004 of the National Survey on Drug Use and Health consisted of 130,152 respondents randomly selected to be representative of the adult population in the United States. Standardized screening measures for past year mental health include serious psychological distress, mental health treatment, inpatient, outpatient medication needed but did not receive, symptoms of 8 psychiatric disorders, panic disorder, major depressive episode, mania, social phobia, general anxiety disorder, agoraphobia, post-traumatic stress disorder, and non-affective psychosis, and 7 specific symptoms of non-affective psychosis. We calculated weighted odds ratios by multivariate logistic regression, controlling for a range of socio-demographic variables, use of illicit drugs, risk-taking behavior, and exposure to traumatic events. Certainly sounds like they tried to cover all the bases. Here are the results. 21,967 respondents reported lifetime psychedelic use. There were no significant associations between lifetime use of any psychedelics, lifetime use of specific psychedelics, LSD, psilocybin, mescaline, peyote, or past year use of LSD and increased rate of any of the mental health incomes. Rather, in several cases, psychedelic use was associated with lower rate of mental health problems. Conclusion: we did not find use of psychedelics to be an independent risk factor for mental health problems. Okay, end of abstract, and I'm not advocating the use of psychedelics, but this is a very interesting report, and I really want to thank Henry for it. Next is a nice long email from champion transcriber Gloria Ullman, who writes, "Hi David, I've just listened to the interview with John Fredrickson and was thrilled once again to hear my email about Mark Winburn's interview read out. At the very end of the show, you played a song by Louise, which had me in tears and reminded me that music can not only connect us with the divine creative spirit, but also act as a catalyst for a healthy kind of catharsis. I resonated so much with Louise's lyrics, and the music itself was beautiful. I hope she is going to make it more public, YouTube at the very least. My washout reminded me that I had said to you I would try and put in words and experience I had while doing the transcript for Mark's interview." She's referring to the interview with Mark Winburn on the blues. Let me start that again. "My washout reminded me that I had said to you I would try to put in words and experience I had while doing the transcript for Mark's interview, not only as a means of sharing my experience for what it's worth, but also as a means of encouragement to anyone who's thinking of doing a transcript of a favorite show. Doing a transcript has a way of making the interview very deep and rich and often therapeutic experience beyond the informative contents, and I do recommend it highly. While doing Mark Winburn's interview, I found myself, as in listening to Louise's song, in tears at one particular point, and it took me a while to realize what it was about. It was when he talked about having to let go of playing with his band in Beale Street because of growing work and family commitments. I could see straight away that it was connected to my own experience of having to let go of my square dance club after my husband died. But it was many years ago, and I thought I was well and truly over it and couldn't understand the intensity of my reaction. Over the next few days, the insights unfolded as they do when you allow the process to digest naturally. I realized it wasn't so much the grief that I hadn't dealt with, but the guilt I had felt for continuing with the club when my husband was dying of cancer. I had trained 4 years as a square dance caller and had finally taken the plunge and started my own club, and within 2 months, my husband was diagnosed with terminal cancer. At first, I thought I would have to give up the club, but I didn't want to let it go. My husband and the dancers were also keen for me to keep it going, and I did manage to until sometime after his death. But for many years afterwards, I felt guilty. I would always rationalize it away, but it wasn't until I had the reaction while listening to Mark that I realized just how much had been sitting in the unconscious. Grief is a very complex set of feelings and emotions, and my own observation is that guilt is one of those insidious emotions that keeps it from being fully expressed and realized. It's not something we can deal with on demand, and consequently the feelings associated with it tend to be triggered in a variety of ways, not always at the most convenient of times. I have to wonder if listening to a topic so close to my heart, and possibly even the sound clips you played during Mark's interview, had primed me for the catharsis. I'm sure you will be pleased to hear that your program makes me cry, and I don't mean to imply that I end up in tears with every transcript, far from it, but it is nevertheless always a rich and rewarding experience. On the note of transcripts, put me down in advance for Nancy Ferlotti. I can't wait to hear the interview. I just saw that there are wildfires raging in your part of the world, and I hope all is well with you. Regards, Gloria. Well, Gloria, I am always touched by the letters that you write, not only the transcripts that you do, but the letters that you write, which are so full of feeling and insight and so well expressed. Speaking of guilt, it makes me feel guilty for the paltry responses that I write to most emails. You have a real gift, Gloria, both for feeling and for depth and for insight, and I really appreciate you so much. Now, this next, and by the way, the wildfires have been truly devastating, having turned much of the area surrounding Yosemite, our precious National Park Yosemite, into what's been called a moonscape. Fortunately, the fires have not personally touched me. None have been anywhere close to where I live. This next one comes from longtime listener and supporter Alan Tabor, and is particularly relevant because he references also both the blues interview with Jungian analyst Mark Winburn and also psychedelics. And Alan writes, "Did you ever get much feedback on the blues clips? I loved it." Well, as a matter of fact, I didn't get much feedback. He goes on to write, "Your guest's taste in blues runs precisely parallel to mine. Here's a few links with Junior Kimbrough's lament, 'Done Got Old.'" And he says in parentheses, "I'm an old guy myself." Well, I'm an old guy myself, and I can relate to it. So he gave me two YouTube links, and I did go to them. I was not aware of Junior Kimbrough, and you can find them on your own. Just look for Junior Kimbrough, Kimbrough. Alan goes on to write, "There's some very interesting stuff happening in a music genre called Americana at the moment. Justin Townes Earl, a young guy, says he thinks country took a wrong turn back in the 70s when they discounted hill country music from where Hank Williams had joined it to the blues. He and a bunch of other young guys seem intent on merging it back together. If you're interested, I could drop a Dropbox folder with a few things." Then he goes on to respond to an email that I think I shared here with somebody who wrote very critically about my appeals for monetary contributions. And so Alan writes, "Regarding money and values in your critic, I had an interesting experience back in the 70s. I saw Nusrat Fateh Ali Khan at a church in Oakland before a primarily South Asian crowd. The audience started throwing money onto the stage, and by the end, it was carpeted with bills and coins. Being a bit of a hippie, I thought, how gauche. A decade later, it occurred to me, one, the musicians, not the label, producer, radio DJ, etc., got all that money, and two, the crowd was showing appreciation by showering Nusrat with direct material support, allowing him to keep body and soul together and continue to provide wonderful music. To To disparage asking for money for producing genuine value creates a world where artists and musicians starve and even mediocre salespeople thrive. Those focused on producing value without some self-promotion are consigned to poverty. And this is about psychology, after all. It sets up an internal dichotomy that's as likely to pull someone to the dark side of the force as it is to keep them pure, since they are blocked from trying to arrange some financial underpinnings to the vision and at some point have to jump tracks. If people's first impulse was to throw money at you for producing something of such great value, you wouldn't have to ask. By the way, I've been listening since I heard you on the Are You Serious show many months ago, and try to keep a steady contribution going despite the vicissitudes of credit card changes that sometimes derails my auto payments. So I thank you for all of that, Alan, and for your long support, your faithful support and encouragement, and for your apology and defense for my appeals for people to be donors. And I keep up the appeals, and despite our relatively large audience, it is not coming to a huge sum, but I very much appreciate it anyway. So I think that better wrap it up for today. You can send your emails to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com, and you can leave comments about individual shows. You can leave voicemails on Skype, where I'm ShrinkPod, and you can leave voicemail on my message phone. Haven't had any in a long time. It's 206-350-9918. Thanks to today's guest, Dr. John Amodeo, for sharing his insights into mindfulness and loving relationships. Now, on the next episode, I'll be speaking with Michael O'Connor, MD, a Canadian psychiatrist who specializes in working with teens. And Dr. O'Connor is a regular listener of Shrink Wrap Radio. And you may have heard me read some of his emails and or comments on the site. So I'm really looking forward to the opportunity to talk with him at some length. And I think you'll like it too. So be there. And until then, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.
This is Grant Strine from Media, Pennsylvania, and you've just been Shrink Wrapped.